Hey everyone, Craig from Acid Horizon here. You are about to listen to part one of a very long discussion we had with Stuart Kendall on Georges Bataille, sustainability, and climate change. Currently, you can listen to the entirety of this episode on our Patreon account if you are a subscriber. Also, you can grab it for free on YouTube if you follow us on our YouTube channel. August of 2023 is the perfect time to subscribe because we are starting two new reading groups. The first is Deleuze's Nietzsche and Philosophy, and we have another reading group as well starting, which is Foucault's Madness and Civilization. It's only a buck to join, or you can subscribe at the $5 or $10 level as well. If you enjoy Acid Horizon and you've thought, yeah, I'll support them at some time, well, now's the time. So navigate to our Patreon account. You can find the link in the show notes. Without further ado, let's bring back Stuart Kendall on Georges Bataille, Sustainability and Climate Change. Welcome back to Zero Books and Repeater Media. This is Craig from Acid Horizon, along with the rest of the crew, Will, Adam, and Noah. Today, we have the honor of speaking once again with a distinguished guest, Stuart Kendall, whom many, if not all of our listeners know as the notable translator of many of Georges Bataille's works, including Guilty, On Nietzsche, Inner Experience, and a few others, not to mention Stuart's own contribution of the biography of Bataille, which he wrote for the Critical Live series. We had Stuart on the show just over a year ago to discuss the influence of Nietzsche on Bataille and French communism, which is probably the episode that I've received the most one-on-one feedback about since starting the podcast. Today, Stuart returns to pick up a discussion on Bataille's concepts of expenditure, eroticism, sovereignty, general and restricted economy, particularly as they relate to the ongoing global climate crisis. We want to know how this work can avail us amidst the catastrophe. In any event, Stuart, you are famous, appreciated, and well-liked by our guests, and it is very nice to see you again.
Well, thank you for that generous, perhaps overstated, exaggerated, maybe even excessive introduction.
Well, this is an episode about excess. So before we begin, could you offer your own introduction and perhaps mention some of your work that you're doing at the moment?
Well, I think you captured it in a nutshell. I've been thinking about writing about translating Georges Bataille and sort of his circle of folks related to him. I've translated books by Maurice Blanchot, Jean Baudrillard, Guy Debord, poetry by Eluard and René Char, a lot of sort of adjacencies to Bataille. I've written about Bataille in the visual arts. I did an anthology of his writings on cave painting, for example. His epistemology and theory of experience in an edited volume called The Unfinished System of Non-Knowledge. The core of my translation work has been his Atheological Summa, as you mentioned, the Inner Experience, Guilty, On Nietzsche. But nevertheless, I've sort of moved across the work, through the work. And alongside that, I've written a series of articles on many topics, but three or so on general economy, expenditure, and waste. I've been doing that while teaching at a design art and design school. So I've been doing that with the goal of informing makers, people who want to understand the world, but people who also want to change the world, to make the things, the tools and technologies, whether they're infrastructural or whatever it might be, that are going to help us navigate living now and in the future. On the one hand, it's for the library, a creature of the archive. But on the other hand, it's for the street. So how do we take these ideas and do something with them is something that I'm very keen to keep in mind at all times. So if I don't go off on too many flights of theoretical fancy, it's for that reason.
Well, it sounds like you're doing good work nonetheless. So, well, with that said, I like to assume that every time we do an episode like this, we have new listeners and people coming to this work for the first time. Bataille has a rich corpus of concepts and conceptual terminology. For example, this distinction between a general versus a restricted economy. He has this notion of expenditure, this concept of eroticism, and sovereignty. These are terms that might come up. We don't have to define all of these all at once, but as we come across them, it might be helpful to explicate them somewhat. But to get started, we have been thinking about Bataille's concept of expenditure for quite a while in our own reading group sessions. But today we wanted to home in on waste as a form of expenditure and how Bataille's concept of waste challenges certain paradigms of production operative in our world today. And you gave us a few essays to look at, including one called Making More of Waste, which perhaps we can share with others after the show. What does Bataille have to say about waste in his work, and how might it avail us in rethinking certain attitudes or norms around the production of excess?
Well, those are a lot of words. And one of the challenges to thinking about Bataille and really all these thinkers who might be related to his work is something I might, on the one hand, think of as a kind of jargon factory, you know, using terms in sort of technical ways that are forbidding to the non-initiate, to the exoteric reader. And so trying to fight our way into his terminology can be a challenge, not least because some of these terms, he uses some of these terms in ways that we don't normally think of their use. So sovereignty, we put usually in a political context. He is thinking of it more typically in terms of just freedom. What does it mean? What is a free entity? Waste has other problems. If we're going to think about what the word waste means, what is it to waste something? How are we wasting? Can we waste our waste? What is the place of waste in society? And this kind of a term for Bataille is ambivalent because we need to think about it and we can't get rid of it. I mean, waste itself. We need to consider where it goes and what it means. It's something that we're human beings. We produce wastes. We cannot deny this. And yet we do. A part of what it means to be a human being is to create a structure that organizes the production of waste. And that's what culture does. Culture allows us to control where and when we spend our energy. And spending and wasting, for Bataille, are very much synonyms. So thinking of a kind of continuum of terms here, and here that continuum includes words like consumption, expenditure, squandering, and waste. Bataille's going to use these terms very often interchangeably. Waste is expenditure. When we expend energy, we are wasting that energy. We're wasting it when we're not investing it in the future, when we're not thinking about what will happen with it later. Now, that creates problems for us. If we're not thinking about what happens with our waste in the future, our future can be imperiled. And this has to do with sustainability, sustainable design. How do we think about the material resources and how we use them, how we consume them, how we expend them? Some other related terms, and I'll circle back into this, but some other related terms are, of course, gift and sacrifice or offering. Another one is squandering. And these are terms that Bataille takes on from a group of his influences, from Marcel Mauss and his notions of the potlatch. But Marcel Mauss also wrote about sacrifice. And then Nietzsche as well. Nietzsche's, the highest value for Nietzsche is the gift-giving virtue, to be someone who will give. But that also can involve, he says, giving is sacrificing. Sacrificing is squandering. So how do we unpack all these things? How do we think about these trajectories? That's at the core of what Bataille is trying to do throughout pretty much his entire project, early to late. He's thinking about these kind of trajectories of expenditure, which is to say the peregrinations of production, consumption, waste. Where do these things go? And to link that back into thinking about sustainability and sustainable design, there's a document called the Hanover Principles that's written by William McDonough and Michael Braungard. And we see this in their book, The Upcycle. And this is something that comes up in other places as well. But one of the core tenets of sustainable design is to, and they say, eliminate the concept of waste. What we need to do is think about waste so that we're not wasting our waste. They very succinctly put it in Cradle to Cradle, one of their books. The modern civilization is a civilization that takes all of its most valuable goods and takes them to the dump, which is, of course, what we do. We dig up rare earths, minerals. We put tremendous energy and technology into manufacturing something like an iPhone, only to have it become obsolete within a matter of months. And then we take those same materials and we throw them in the dump. We isolate them from ourselves. So how do we reformulate the circulation of material, energy, all these things? How do we reorganize all of that so that we're not wasting our waste, so that we can make more out of our waste? That's the core question for Bataille and for, I think, for us when we're thinking about sustainable design. That was a pretty long statement, though. So,
no, that's great. In fact, this takes me to a question that was lingering ever since the last time that we spoke with you. Noah had asked you a question in our previous episode regarding how we could make more resilient communities or practices. And your response suggested that we shouldn't be aiming for resilience per se, but rather considering the life cycle of our creations amidst a host of other concerns. And one of the phrases you used was that phrase cradle to cradle, which I believe is an idea that encompasses all of these statements and ideas. Could you talk a little bit more about that? I know you included that in the essay, Making More of Waste. What does it mean, cradle to cradle, and how is this perhaps an instantiation of Bataille's ideas about waste?
Yeah, so we're talking about a couple of different things here. And I don't want to badmouth resilience. We need resilient systems, but we do need to think about a whole bunch of things. And that is part of Bataille's message too. Another thing that I think is very important when we're thinking about Bataille and these matters is that he's a paradoxical thinker. So Bataille is going to say almost always two things at once. And when we're reading Bataille, we tend to focus, I think a lot of people tend to focus maybe on one side of his work rather than another, whereas he brings things together. So Bataille talks, for example, about both taboos, so moral injunctions against things, and transgression. A lot of Bataille's readers are going to focus more on that transgression. They're going to say, we need to really transgress. We need excess. That's what matters most. And he says, luxury is the big problem. So the excess does matter most, but we don't have excess without the taboos, without the moral regulation. We need both. And he says as well that when we think about, and this is an early essay on the use value of the Marquis de Sade, he says in a post-revolutionary culture, because at that point he was still dreaming of a communist revolution. In a post-revolutionary culture, we're going to have to think both about the sort of rational organization of society. So how do we do things in the best possible way? As well as places for burning passion, for the festival, for orgiastic fervor, all that kind of stuff. So Bataille wants us to both have, reason and that which exceeds reason. So we need to think about how that all ties into this production, consumption, regulation, waste, all those kinds of ideas. We need the regulation. We need the orderliness because we'll die without it. But on the other hand, humans are passionate creatures. We need that place for passion. We need to design passion into our social systems. We need to design ways to enjoy ourselves into these social systems. We need to, in other words, also design places for waste. We need those places where we can let things go and places for disgust. We need the sacred horror of waste, which is another topic that we need to sort of link to. But you asked about the cradle-to-cradle design philosophy. So again, it's a book by William McDonough and Michael Braunger, but it refers to a much wider array of design strategies, and they didn't even originate that term. It's a notion that has a much wider applicability, but it's a very clear one. And what it means is you take a resource, you have it go through a cycle of production into a good that we can use, and then that good at the end of its life cycle, whether that is of short duration or long duration, can be recuperated into a new resource of some kind. So what that means is that you go from the first cradle resource acquisition to a new cradle. The moment of waste is the moment when we return to that second cradle. The flow of what they call nutrients, resources, goes through different phases. The life of an object goes through different phases, but it's never lost or interrupted utterly or broken. The example that they use to talk about breaking resource cycles is what they call monstrous hybrids. when we bring things together in such a way that they can no longer be taken apart or reused. And at that point, what can you do with them? Nothing. Take them to the dump. We take a lot of our resources, we turn them into monstrous hybrids, we take them to the dump. So we need to design social systems that regulate this process. And this stuff is already happening in many industries. In some countries, the production of automobiles has already taken on this quality capacity, so that an automobile producer has to think about the full life cycle of all the nutrients that go into that car. You make the car, you better be ready to get that car back, to take it apart, and to make it into something else, to take those pieces and put it into something else. So that's the management of nutrient flows. And in the cradle-to-cradle world, we can think about natural resource flows and technical resource flows. So these are different types of resources. And when we cross the streams, sometimes we cross the streams chemically. We build a chemical and technical process that's going to ruin or spoil our natural resources. And of course, living in New Jersey, I'm very familiar with that as a problem. Nevertheless, this is a thing we need to regulate, we need to pay attention to, we need to think about. We don't want to cross our nutrient streams. We need to figure out where we're going with these flows. But again, what their goal is with Cradle to Cradle is the elimination of waste, for there to be uninterrupted flow. Now, Bataille is more attentive to the moments of transition between these states of things. And I think that's also important for us as, say, consumers, as users of goods, as shoppers. We need to ask questions like, where did this thing come from? Who's the farmer that grew this food? How did they grow this food? How did it come to us? What is the entire flow? Then what am I doing with it? How am I preparing it? Is this food packaged? Because packaging is a big problem with production of food. We produce more packaging than we do food for a lot of people. And we consume and waste that packaging. How can we eliminate that? And then what happens when we are engaged with the production of that food, like when we're cooking? How are we doing that? What cultural practices are we engaged with? What nutritional practices are we engaged with? And then what's going to happen after that? Composting programs, recycling programs, these are elements, offshoots of that kind of concern. What sort of a feast might be related to our consumption of calories? Bataille is going to have us think about all the elements of that. I'm just using food as one example. But the point here is to think about all of this resource or extraction, engagement, production, consumption, as it filters through culture, institutions, and any number of economies. This also goes back to the terms that you laid out a few minutes ago, or some of them, the notion of a restricted economy versus a general economy. A restricted economy for Bataille is anything that we can isolate. So we can look at the production of a meal, for example, just to stick with that, and we can say, I acquired these ingredients from the grocery store. I made this meal and I ate it. But we have to widen the frame, according to Bataille. It's not just I went to the grocery store. It's who grew this? How did they grow it? What happened to that field? What was it that grew the grass that the cow ate when we made that burger? And then what's going to happen to the rest of that burger when we put it in our, do we put it in the trash? Do we put it in the compost bin? Where does it go? To go from the restricted, restrained, the one way of seeing things in a very limited fashion, to a much more general way of seeing the circulation of goods. And of course, those terms also have many other meanings for Bataille. They have disciplinary meanings. A restricted economy could be one discursive register, one disciplinary frame. Philosophers ask one type of question, or theologians ask one type of question. Sociologists have a particular focus, art historians. And Bataille is trying to work in a more general way, a way that moves beyond specialized concerns into thinking about the ways that that human beings live in a more holistic manner, all of it. So it's not just the production of knowledge, which might be the sphere of philosophers, according to Patai, but rather the production of value, which might be the concern of theologians. So how do we bring all those things together? Restricted, general, the circulation of resources, natural, technical, through culture, through institutions, through disciplines, through human practices. And I'll also say, before I pause on this point, that what we're talking about here is the three ecologies. Patai is very interested in the environment. He's interested in human practices that engage with that environment. And he's also interested in social forms that give shape, that rise out of those human practices, but also get tied back into the environment, the natural world. In the ancient world, and here I'm just following Patai's examples, in the ancient world, we had agrarian rites, religious rites of sacrifice that tied us to the earth, tied us to seasons, that tied the human body to a physical place in a social group. But in the modern world, death of God, we don't have any of that. We don't have sacrificial practices that tie us to anything. We have modes of consumption, which are fun, but we don't have ways of tying ourselves to those ecologies into what, in ways that Gregory Bateson would call meta patterns, patterns that connect us. And that's what Patai is getting at. That's what Bateson is getting at. That's what I'm trying to get at as well. But I've just said a whole lot of things. Does somebody want to?
No, it's fascinating. And I do definitely want to pass it to the other comrades. But I want to just point out something that I thought was very interesting and thought-provoking about your response or series of responses, which is the importance of culture and sometimes what we think of in terms of economic determinism, right? As it being a kind of construct, not only that which establishes a mode of production, as we might say, but also that which then filters production through modes of consumption and modes of waste. And not seeing culture merely as a topological effect of the economy, but something that's important. And we can save this question for later. Maybe you can say something about it now, but like, how do we then deal with cultural difference across the globe, given that we have constructed this massive apparatus of global production and consumption? But we'll come back to that. I want others to speak first. We'll give it to Noah. Noah, do you have anything? Noah helped us set up this episode, so hop in, Noah.
Yeah, no, I'm happy to be here. I appreciate your comments so far. I think that something that's been on some of our minds is, as we finish The Accursed Share Volume 2, which in our emails I kind of alluded to, that we've been struggling with. You explained that it was an unfinished document, more of a series of notes than something meant to be published. But the idea of eroticism as a way of that as a method that Patai uses to kind of approach these sort of different, as maybe as Craig has put it, these manners of metabolism of flows, right? And maybe you could just for a moment explain why eroticism is not just a buzzword. Or why that might actually be a useful part of his corpus, because he does spend a good amount of time talking about it. And you've mentioned that there is a psychological and emotional effect of loss, of waste, that is kind of lost upon some of the design theory that we might have, or the ones that you confront. And so maybe this is how. This leads us to Deleuze and Guattari with a libidinal economy or passions and desires, right? Or things along those lines, and how these worlds like intermingle, if you will. And that's why I think Patai is very useful. But he often, as you said to the exoteric reader, it's hard to maybe crack like what he's talking about when it comes to eroticism. So maybe just like a meditation on that would be helpful, and we could kind of go from there with various questions.
Yeah, eroticism is a tough one in this sort of circuit. So one thing to say about it is that Patai approaches eroticism as a sort of privileged example. He says it's the best model for thinking about expenditure. And that's the way he characterizes it, particularly in Tears of Eros. He says we can either have the buildup of weapons of destruction. he's particularly concerned about war. But that also has to do with poverty, with famine. We can have the distinction between the rich and the poor get wider and wider, or we can find an outlet for expenditure that is, as he says, modeled on the instant consumption of eroticism. So eroticism is instant consumption. It's a model for thinking about expenditure. It's not the only type of expenditure. It's just a privileged model. People love it. People are familiar with it. It's a good example. So what does he mean by that? And what are the other examples of expenditure? The list is not that long. And these are, again, sort of Bataille's privileged examples. And then we'll circle back to eroticism. His privileged examples are laughter. Laughter is a rupture in sense. We sit, we use words intentionally. We're very serious people. We develop knowledge. But all of a sudden, we can be ridiculous. And we can disrupt that entire restricted economy of sense through laughter, through jokes. And our laughter can be utterly convulsive. And that's a tremendous relief for us psychologically. It's a rupture of the spirit of seriousness, as he would say. So laughter is a mode of expenditure, one. He talks about poetry. Poetry is a similar disruption of the sense of language. When words all of a sudden mean two things, we have a sacrifice of meaning. We have a plethora of meaning. Words go off the rails. That's what he means by poetry. Poetry isn't mere communication in a very direct sense, the way that philosophy aspires to be or often aspires to be. Poetry is the multiplicity, the proliferation, the prodigality of meaning. And it's a squandering of meaning in that sense. So poetry, too, is a mode of expenditure. Sacrifice, in the religious sense, is a mode of expenditure, which we talked about briefly. Sacrifice is a way of communing with a group, creating community by making offerings. And there's a lot more to say about this word sacrifice, which I'm not going to say right now. But sacrifice is a mode of expenditure, or it was in ancient and alternate civilizations. We have repressed sacrifice. And just as like we have repressed expenditure in general, we've repressed waste in contemporary culture. So we have these kinds of things. Now, eroticism is a privileged example for him. It's privileged because we can understand it, because it's thorough. He spends a lot of time talking about it. That's not to say that Bataille and Wilhelm Reich are saying exactly the same thing. Now, Wilhelm Reich thought that eroticism was the actual solution, that the orgasm is the problem. And that's not what Bataille is saying. Bataille is saying that the orgasm is a way of thinking about or modeling the problem, this instant consumption. In desire and in eroticism for Bataille, we are no longer concerned with the future. Eroticism is not about reproduction. Eroticism is the immediate expression of desire. And that can be very problematic for individuals, because in that desire, he says in the book Eroticism from 1957, he says that eroticism is assenting to life up to the point of death, which is a sort of, well, we can link that to various thinkers, as I will in a second. But that's a very strange thing to say. It's saying that I will go along with this. I desire this. I'm going to let my desires lead me where they will. And that's not how we normally live. Normally, we live in a restrained way. If desire runs rampant, culture, we can't do anything, basically. If we desire all of our coworkers, if we can't go to the doctor's office without experiencing desire, if there are no taboos, no locations for, no times for the unleashing or unfolding or flowering of desire, then culture is haywire. And so Bataille understands all of that, and he's very attentive to all that kind of stuff. And what he's saying there is again, it's a couple of things. It's that we are part of the life of the cosmos. This desire that we have to overspill ourselves, to let ourselves go, that's how energy is displaced in the cosmos. And we can live at the level of the cosmos or equal to the cosmos. A measure of the cosmos, he would say. So So we can do that in this moment of desire, but that can also be our death. So that's not how we usually do it. Right? Because we need to raise those children that are the result of that desire. Somebody's got to be around. And so we have more measured approaches. We say, this is okay at this time with this person. So marriage becomes the space in which desire can be expressed. We select the individual and we become attentive to that relationship. We carefully curate the deployment of our desire so that we can be respectful. And this is where we see many of Bataille's influences coming together on this. This is, again, why it's a privileged example for him. He links this understanding of desire to the Marquis de Sade, for whom desire is everything. And for Bataille, the Marquis de Sade is a kind of anti-Hegel. For Hegel, knowledge is everything. For Bataille, desire is everything. And again, desire is this overflowing of energy. It's the exuberance of life. Now, is that what Sade really thought? Not exactly. Bataille reads Sade and everyone else extremely selectively. After 1949, Bataille's reading of Sade shifts slightly because he's so overwhelmed by the way that Maurice Blanchot presented Sade in his book and Sade, in that essay on Sade, on Sade's reason. Before that, Bataille thinks about Sade very often, and I do think that Sade is a sort of secret key to thinking about Bataille's work. And we can see Sade sort of behind a lot of his other arguments. Nevertheless, it's a very selective reading of Sade, and I don't think we should confuse it with the real thoughts of the real Marquis de Sade. Nor should we consider Bataille's Sade to be the Sade of Sadism in the clinical sense of that. Bataille has no sense of these things whatsoever. He had read the Havelock Ellis and reviewed that in the 1930s. But he's not taken with this. This is not his concern. What he's concerned with is finding privileged examples that say what he wants to say. It's the paranoid critical method. I think this, and I find it in the world, therefore it is true. So this notion that he gets in Sade that desires the truth of the world, we see that in Freud, in Beyond the Pleasure Principle, the goal of life is death. We see that in Nietzsche, this notion of squandering being the highest virtue. So it's this overflowing that Bataille is concentrating on, and it's eroticism as that overflow that he thinks of as this kind of this privileged way of thinking about it. And Bataille also says, then my final point on this point, Bataille also says about Sade and about eroticism that no one takes Sade seriously, that we shouldn't take Sade seriously. We shouldn't admire the Marquis de Sade. We shouldn't admire what he proposes. Bataille is clear. Sade himself was in prison the whole time. And that means that he didn't have the wild orgies that he describes. He dreamed about those wild orgies because he was in prison. So while there may have been some, there were undoubtedly, and he went to prison because of them. There were some wild orgies, but the truly the mad flights, the utter flights, the dreams of the Marquis de Sade are things that he proposes that are utterly in excess of social reality. And yet that as an evidence of the sort of pure horror of dreams and desires, that's what matters to Bataille. It's an extreme case. So just as Hegel dreams of a purified, absolutely complete rationality, a pure reason, and a world of utter regulation, Sade dreams of a world of utter desire and complete. And Bataille knows that there's no purity. There's no absolute expenditure, and there's no absolute regulation. So there is only somewhere in the middle, and what we need to figure out is what that middle is. And how that middle is going to work for each of us as individuals and for communities. And that also means maintaining the difference of our interests. And that goes back to something we were talking about just a second ago. There's geographical difference, cultural difference. There's differences of age. Promoting difference is one of Bataille's interests. So non-logical difference is how he perceives the material world, and we are part of that. So we desire different things at different times for different reasons, and creating a I'm going to call it immoralism, but it's ultimately a hypermoralism, words that he's using, borrowing from Nietzsche, that is flexible enough to accommodate those differences of desire and regulating them in appropriate ways. That's what's at stake. That's what we're trying to do here.
That's utterly fantastic. And I think that's probably the best description of eroticism that we have been working with. With that said, we'll go to Adam and then Will. Adam.
Yes, I mean, first and foremost, thank you for coming back on the show. It's great to talk to you today, absolutely. I mean, I'm really loving the stuff you're talking about, particularly with Cradle to Cradle, in light of these Bataillean ideas of how do we, rather than eliminating waste in the traditional means of sustainability, how do we, in a way, waste better? Not fail better, as Beckett said, but waste better. And I think this is such a important concept for kind of the main ways in which luxury is a problem in the face of the current climate crisis, not in the sense of individualizing it. The idea of an individual's carbon footprint was a PR campaign for Shell, but even stuff which we all constantly engage in. I mean, for example, commercial air travel. Well, why do people fly commercial air travel? Well, partially for convenience, but why is it convenient? Why is it useful? It's useful because we only have so many vacation days off a year because we're constantly being called back to work at certain times. And so the luxury of a commercial air travel, which is a global, well, predominantly, yeah, more or less global phenomenon, is the problem, but it's a problem because we're not wasting better in a way. We can't take luxurious tours to get to our various holiday destinations. We can't even spend in the vicinities we're in because we always get confined within the border, the airport terminal. We have to get to the location we plan to get to because we need to get back to and from as quick as possible. So we can't waste our time so we can actually properly go waste things in the place because we need to fix it there. Otherwise, we've wasted our vacation. We've wasted our waste. Now, exactly. I had a question really about this, particularly in Bataille's work. It seems like there could be a bit of a transition in his work or a tension between sort of the earlier ways Bataille thinks about how to waste better and the later ways. Because towards the end of The Accursed Chair, Volume 1, he's more systematic. Yeah, he's absolutely sort of harking or sort of heralding the arrivals of people such as Gregory Bateson, the cyberneticists, even, I mean, the question of it was the designing sovereignty as a tribute to Stafford Beer's Designing Freedom, there's echoes of Cybersyn and stuff. But
yeah,
this question of, and of course, you in your own work, you bring in Buckminster Fuller, who literally treats the planet as a giant spaceship that we are piloting. And so he takes a cosmic view of the use and abuse of energy for life here. But do you think that in Bataille's later work, the overall systematization risks reducing the political element that you may get in, for example, his early essay, The Notion of Expenditure, where the real sort of mode of wasting better is first and foremost class struggle, and then sort of doing it in a very cyclical way, almost like how de Sade's Libertine talks about waste in Philosophy in the Bedroom, where he says, because the Republic is founded on the murder of a king, it's founded upon crime, and therefore any properly Republican society must be constantly committing murderous crimes, constantly wasting in order to still remain what it is. And also the question of inner experience, because inner experience is a book that laughs in the face of project. It tries to do a project without project. And does that make Bataille, in a way, sort of, is there a tension within himself when it comes to doing these grand policy proposals or grand systemic mappings? I mean, it's not to say these are bad at all, but I'm just asking if there's a tension there, because at the end of the Accursed Share, he's no longer saying sort of class struggle. He's not necessarily saying revolution. He's saying, well, the Soviets have absolutely fucked this up. They're going to keep producing infinitely for production's sake until they collapse, which quite funnily they did, of course. And the Americans, we have to hope that the Americans will keep Marshall planning using their surplus in this way. And then sadly, the military industrial complex came in with a steel chair and ruined that prediction. But yeah, I guess, is there a tension between the idea of designing systems of waste for Bataille and sort of the earlier politics of waste, or is there a sort of synthetic unity between the two in which non-knowledge, this other side of knowledge, this side of wasting sense, wasting experience, can that play a role in which we can actually design non-knowledge in a way? Is it designable?
Well, yeah, so these, you're raising a lot of questions here that I think are very, very important to think about as we're reading Bataille, as we sort of pull any book off the shelf and look for solutions inside of it. So on the one hand, I will say that the basic theory, the primary point that he's trying to make, the division of the world between these two types of experience, the regulated and the unregulated, the taboo and the transgression, that is there in the Use Value of Marquis de Sade, written roughly 1930. It's also there in Eroticism, 1957, his sort of final statement. So the core of it remains consistent. Now, within that, though, Bataille is responsive to the events of history. He's a guy who wrote in dialogue. He wrote in dialogue with his influences. So he first reads Nietzsche under the tutelage of Lev Shestov. Then he studies psychoanalysis through psychoanalysis with Adrian Borel in the 1920s. He reads the Marquis de Sade in the context of the surrealist moment, also in the 1920s, when Sade is just beginning to be published. And there's more to say about that. Like, Bataille starts writing about Sade before there is any Sade to read. So we need to remember that. But then he turns against many of these things. He doesn't truly engage with Hegel until the 1930s, when he's more or less already framed out the way that he sees things. And that helps him to turn to anthropology, which he'd already done in the 1920s with his friend Alfred Metro. Mm. And he sort of plays each one of these disciplines and discourses off of one another as he looks for ways to frame his own thought. So that in 1938, for example, he can set Freud aside. He says, in this psychoanalytic study group on the topic of death that he set up alongside the College of Sociology, the introductory lecture to that, he says, Freud is great, but he doesn't have a lot to say about anthropology. So we need to study anthropology much more deeply. And that is to say, psychoanalysis takes a backseat, and Bataille doesn't mention Freud again in his writing. The some of the structures that are there because they're at the base of his thought, but the references are no longer there. Similarly with anthropology, Bataille has the adventure of thought that is the 1940s, including all of his responses to World War II, to the political climate of France in the post-war period, to the global political crisis that follows in that, and the drama with communism is part of those things. And then in that same exact moment, he gives the lecture in February of 1948 that he will rewrite as Theory of Religion. And afterwards, in the discussion after this lecture, Mircea Eliade, who had been in the audience, says, "You clearly haven't read any anthropology recently." So it's like Bataille is using all these anthropological models, but he hasn't been paying enough attention. And I think there's some chagrin there, because what does he do? He writes the book, but he doesn't publish it. Theory of Religion stays in the desk drawer, and Bataille turns to the deep study of history. And to more contemporary anthropological texts. He reads Levi-Strauss. He starts writing about Lascaux. And he writes that first version of the Eroticism book. At first, it's a book on Sade. He rewrites that in dialogue with Camus so that it reconceives it. Then he writes it as the history of eroticism in this kind of dialogue with anthropology. That's not working out. So it doesn't get finished. He doesn't finish that book, and he ends up rewriting it in 1956 for publication as Eroticism in 1957. So you see him in each one of these moments pivoting. Now, again, there, the history of eroticism, written in the spring of 1951, and the text related to the book Sovereignty, which is also related to the Accursed Chair project and has its own history and historical problems. Those writing projects are both profoundly derailed by the death of Joseph Stalin in 1953, in my interpretation. With the death of Stalin, you have a utterly transformed context of communism and thinking about politics, political economy, et cetera. So at that same moment, Bataille is also diagnosed with the condition that will eventually kill him. So he's got massive health problems. Stalin is dead. He's trying to figure out what direction to take. Do we go more philosophical? Do we go anthropological? Where is all this going? Now, for the Anglophone reader of Bataille, all these things are utterly absent, right? The texts of theory of religion and history of eroticism and sovereignty, these are presented as though they were effectively complete works, as though someone had gone into Bataille's trunk and said, oh, look, whole books, let's publish them. Similarly with the Limits of Utility from 1940. When Bataille wrote each of these books, he was responding to very specific conditions. And those conditions are more or less obliterated by the publications. So they're sort of flattened. So my cautionary word is to pay very close attention to the context. If Bataille is writing in praise of Marxist revolution in 1933, he's partly doing it because he's publishing that essay in La Critique Sociale. And they have, Boris Sovrin already said, I don't know about this. He said, I don't know about this strongly enough to put a header, a disclaimer on the essay when they published it. So Bataille throwing a little bit more of let's be concerned about class struggle. But, you know, he didn't publish that essay again. That essay vanished. He rewrote the thing multiple times before it becomes the accursed chair. And it's not just him deepening his thought. It's him writing for a new context. My final point on this. The accursed chair, published in 1949, written and rewritten from ideas developed over 18, 20 years. We first see the residue of that in the late 1920s, even. So Bataille was working on those ideas, and when he publishes The Accursed Chair, it's a sliver. It's already a volume one of a project that he hoped would be multiple volumes. He thought that there would be another volume which went into more of the science of ecology, you know, what we now call ecology. He thought he would write that book with George Ambrosino, who's a physicist. And so he thought there would be more of this biosphere stuff in there. There'd be more atomic physics, all those things which he knew that he could not write in a convincing manner. So he believed that there would be a second volume written along with Ambrosino, or maybe just published in the series that he was editing for Edition de Minuit at that time. But nevertheless, he knew that there was a wider constellation of thought. So some of the things are not present for political reasons, for change. And some of them are not present because he thought they would be elsewhere in his publications, but that never happened for various reasons. So there are the books that Bataille published under all these schemes. And then there are the ones that he failed to publish, that he chose not to publish. You also mentioned inner experience, which in some way is his, it's his most disastrous book as a book that he published, because it's a complete mess. It's like a kitchen sink volume or kettle volume. It's got everything in there. It's got some poems. It's got some autobiography. It's got some theory stuff. It's got some wacky thought about Hinduism and resurrection. It's got an essay on Marcel Proust. He's got all that stuff in there. It's simultaneously organized and intentionally disorganized, which I have said in other occasions. And I think it's very important when we're reading Inner Experience. He interrupts himself all the time. He's very concerned about whether or not the book is fulfilling a project. Is he going where he intended to go? So Bataille is very conscious in Inner Experience, and in, if you look at the preface to The Accursed Chair, he's very conscious of the fact that he shouldn't be, and I'm going to say this, wasting his time like this, using discursive terms to capture non-discursive experiences is against his philosophy. His philosophy should be a mess. It should be a balanced, explosive. It should be like a sort of contained supernova. And that's what he's trying to capture in the style of Inner Experience. But he knows that's a mess. So he dreams, already in the 1940s, of writing in a more coherent and convincing manner. Because he knows it's important, right? And here we are talking about it. It's important. But how do we talk about it? How do we organize those thoughts? How do we present them?